Okay, Little Prince meets Pilate. In our story, the little prince has been on Earth now for almost a year when he finally runs into a human being, the stranded airplane pilot. The pilot is asleep on the sand, and the little prince wakes him with a request. The little prince wakes him with a request. Draw me a sheep, please. What? Draw me a sheep. The pilot's completely thunderstruck. He rubs his eyes, blinks hard, and looks carefully around, and there's this extraordinary little boy watching him gravely. So the pilot draws him the only thing he knows how to draw, a boa constrictor from the outside that looks to all the grown-ups like a hat. The pilot is astonished when the little fellow says, "No, no, I don't want an elephant inside a boa constrictor. A boa constrictor is very dangerous, and an elephant would get in the way. Where I live, everything is very small. I need a sheep. Draw me a sheep." Now, I might pause here for a moment. Do you know why the little prince needs a sheep? Because the baobabs, the scourge of the baobabs, is taking over his planet. This is one of the interesting things about this story. If we remember, the defensive system, once it's in place, has a lot of aggression in it. And the aggression in this story is not very apparent. But what I said to you before about how there's a gradual deterioration and devolution of the structure of the self-care system once the defense is in place is in the story in the form of these baobabs. These are an infestation that are taking over the planet. And in other words, his little idyllic world is now infected with a negative, destructive process, and he has to go outside the system in order to get help for it. So he comes down and he needs a sheep. Sheep eat baobabs, at least they do when the baobabs are little. So the pilot, now suddenly awakened to his early forgotten artistic life, draws a sheep. But the little prince is not satisfied with this sheep, nor with the next one, nor with the next one, until finally the pilot draws a box with three holes in it and explains to the little prince that his sheep is inside. Now the little prince is completely satisfied. "Look," he says, the little prince says, bending over the drawing, "he's gone to sleep." Now, in this charming initial contact, don't we have a wonderful example of a connection made on the level of the child's imagination? Child to child, one might say. The pilot has not met anyone in 30 years who understood his drawing of the boa constrictor, and the little prince has not met a grown-up who understood, as the fox said, that it is only with the heart that one can see clearly. And I think there are moments like this in the psychotherapy situation where true healing happens. Perhaps they are moments when the patient feels deeply understood for the first time in a long time. Such moments happen for the therapist as well. Perhaps the genuine innocent yearning within the child in the patient awakens in the therapist his or her own longings, and a heartfelt glance or smile is exchanged. Often the child-to-child moments are completely unplanned. A funny moment in which the therapist says something totally absurd, or puts his foot in it somehow, or a story the patient tells hits the funny mode of the therapist, so that a healing moment of laughter is shared. Sometimes a dream will occur in which a new meaning is spotted by both parties, and you have that magic moment where the imagination heals both of you. Or synchronicity will occur in therapy, and we'll hear about that tomorrow. Some moments where, completely unbidden, a connection will be made that's miraculous. Like Jung's example of the scarab flying through the window. You all remember that story? The patient had just dreamt of a golden scarab, and they were puzzling over the dream, and Jung reported that this woman who reported that dream was very intellectualized and very literalized, very literal, tended to take everything literally, and she couldn't get to the imaginal or the symbolic dimension of what these dreams might mean. And suddenly in flies a scarab. Jung reaches up and catches it in his hand and hands it to her and says, "Here's your scarab." Whereupon she's just overcome with amazement, and suddenly, according to Jung, that broke through to a deeper, playful, and mysterious acknowledgement of what was going on. As Barbara and I began our analytic adventure together against the backdrop of her green monster dream, her psyche began to outpicture in dreams further evidence that something dreadful had happened to her innocence, some kind of early attachment trauma when she was very young. We did not know what this was until a fortuitous event occurred. Around the end of our third year together, Barbara's maternal uncle died, and letters from her mother to this uncle were found and sent to Barbara. These letters spanned the period of her infancy. In one letter, dated on the occasion of little Barbara's younger sister's birth, her mother extolled the virtues of her newborn baby, adding as an afterthought, "I can report no news of Barbie, as I haven't seen her for so long." At the time, Barbara was only 16 months old, a crucial time in an infant's attachment to her mother. Further investigation found that little Barbara had been sent to live with another relative while the mother went to hospital and gave birth to the baby sister, not an unusual experience, but this separation had lasted over 8 weeks. Here was a major rupture in the infant-mother attachment bond unknown until now. Suddenly, Barbara and I acquired a new understanding of that feeling that she often had that she described as speechless horror, what she called her deer-in-the-headlights panic at certain times of abject terror around abandonment. At these times, she would fall into what Michael Balint called a basic fault. She would lose herself dry-mouthed, for example, when she entered a new group of people, wordlessly frozen in the face of real or potential rejection. Despite her many accomplishments and her completely normal life in other respects, she carried a deep sense of insecurity, always stimulated by the petrifying threat of loss of love. This new information in the letter also gave us an explanation for what she had early described as her chronic headbanging as a child. As we reviewed this early history together, we could sense the presence of a dying planet with its split-off innocent creatures, the place maybe where Barbara's innocence went for safekeeping when nothing satisfying was possible with her actual mother. Instead, this soul part of herself was held by the green monster. I also review here some of the other later experiences with this mother, including the giving away of the kitten. So I won't review that now. This was a terrible struggle that started now at this part of the analysis. She began to regress and to feel a renewal of this panic. She became much more sensitive to my absences. And I worked out a way of letting her know when I was on vacation that I would be in touch with her, and we managed to find a way through Skype and other contacts so that she could keep her sessions going. And she said she was feeling very small, like she wanted me to carry around her around in my pocket. So the early experiences were now being repeated and remembered through the repetition in the transference. And through the struggle that we worked on together, although it was a stormy time, it was not without its sunny periods. Barbara began to matter to me, and I to her. I was very moved by her courage and passionate search to find the lost parts of herself, and I began to find our weekly meetings increasingly meaningful. This mutual affection and genuine caring seemed to open up the landscape of another planet inside her, and the equivalent of the little prince began to make his appearance. We began to piece together a coherent history of her early life, and things began to make sense. This was, I think, the taming period. We were coming to matter to each other, and the process was mattering to both of us. as if to give some encouragement to these remote parts of her that she was beginning to risk in the attachment relationship with me, she had the following dream. Now, this is a kind of complicated dream, but I'll go through it slowly. I'm a young woman in Antarctica. Now, remember, the previous planet was frozen. I'm pregnant. I'm part of the remnant of a tribe like Eskimos up there, with whom I've lived until recently. In other words, she's lived in the Antarctica with this tribe of Eskimos until recently. Now the remnant of my tribe are living in a kind of settlement, I'm living there too, established by the Russians on the very edge of this territory. The remnant of my tribe has decided that they have to leave the settlement and return to the interior and to the old ways. This is a secret that must not be found out by the Russians, who are very keen to have them assimilate with the modern culture. I, however, am somehow appointed to help them escape back into the interior, into their aboriginal homeland. These people seem to feel, and they feel like my people, that they must go back to the old ways because they have lived in this settlement for a generation or more, but they've lost the ability to build igloos or something. They have little huts to live in, but nothing to do. It's taken the soul out of them. They lead a stifled and stunted existence without anything to live for. I cannot go back with my people, however. It's a risk. My people feel they must either leave or die trying. I feel very supportive. I say, go back. Recover your souls. I want them to be free. And it's very sad because I won't see them again and will never belong to them like I have for years, because I want my baby to be born in the modern world. This is my dilemma. My pregnancy means I can't go with them. I must return with the Russians to civilization, where there will be better food, more opportunities for the baby, and medical care. The baby is a boy. It's not clear if I'll be allowed to keep the baby. My job is simply to get this baby born. He's not my baby in some profound way. I am a kind of channel for his entry into life, but I don't have control over him. He can then live either as a Russian or not. That is what life has presented me. It's a just-so story. Now, do you see the parallels between the earlier Green Monster dream? Only this time, well, see if I can say it. We both instantly recognize the similarity between this dream and the earlier dream. A frozen landscape, albeit this time not on another planet. And this time she's pregnant and the carrier of a child whose father is unknown, and the baby doesn't belong just to her either. The baby is the baby, in effect, of two worlds. The aboriginal Eskimo world, where the pregnancy took place, and the adapted ego of modern Russia, where the baby will be born safely and live its life. What does this suggest? One thing that occurred to us is that Barbara was now the emissary, delivering her unborn baby from the frozen world to this world, and she was doing this for the child's safety. It was as though she had taken over the function of the Green Monster. Her strong feeling in the dream was grief that she would lose her special relationship to these Eskimo people. She was making a transition and doing so for the sake of the child and its potential life. At the time, Barbara and I did not recognize the potential symbolic implications of her bearing a dream child with dual origins and a mysterious unknown father. These factors made her dream a kind of annunciation dream. The child she carried seemed like something more than just her child. He was a little prince, and what he represented was somehow related to the mystery of her own individuation process. She must love this child without possessing it. And the affective marker of this fact was the great sadness she felt in the dream about having to leave the frozen land where she had lived for a whole generation and loved those people. Like in The Little Prince, the two worlds must remain separated as innocence enters experience. Love and grief are the elastic that holds them together. So to return to our story, in the next stage, we find that the little prince is teaching the pilot the lessons he's learned from the fox. It has now been 8 days since the pilot has broken down. In other words, the little prince has been on this planet for, been on the Earth for a longer time than the pilot. He's broken down, and it's now 8 days, and he's out of water. The little prince suggests they go to look for a well in the desert. A very stupid idea, the pilot thinks. But somehow, the pilot has been touched by the little prince, and so he consents. They walk all day and into the night, finally sitting down under the stars in silent reverie. The stars are beautiful, says the little prince. Because of a flower you don't see. And what makes the desert so beautiful, he continues, is that it hides a well somewhere. He's talking about the invisible rose up there. The stars are beautiful, he says, because of a flower you don't see. And what makes the desert so beautiful is that it hides a well somewhere. The pilot begins to understand that the invisible secrets hidden in the human heart are the source of life's beauty and meaning. And suddenly he is deeply moved. He picks up the sleeping little prince in his arms and walks into the night. He is suddenly in touch with the exquisite beauty and vulnerability that the fragile, innocent creature in his arms seems to be. The pilot says to himself, it's as if I'm carrying a fragile treasure. It actually seemed to me that there was nothing more fragile on the whole earth. By the light of the moon, I gazed at that pale forehead, those closed eyes, those locks of hair trembling in the wind, and I said to myself, what I'm looking at is only a shell. What is most important is invisible.